and welcome to The Big Web Show, episode number 130. I am your host, Jeffrey Zeldman. Today's episode is sponsored by An Event Apart, the design conference for people who make websites. And today's guest knows quite a bit about making websites. He is developer, author, lecturer, explorer, and Sherpa, Aaron Gustafson. Aaron, welcome.
Hey, Jeffrey, how's it going?
Good.
I'm in Chattanooga today.
Yeah.
I am not on the road.
That is exciting.
It's good to be home. It's a little rainy out, but other than that, we're good.
How has the winter been in Chattanooga?
It's actually been not too bad. I mean, we don't get too much of any one season, which is kind of nice. So we got about 8 inches of snow one day. We made some, my wife Kelly, she made a snow kitty. So a little cat out of snow. And then the next day it was all melted. So, you know, it doesn't stick around long here.
And you're by a river?
Yeah, the Tennessee River runs right through the middle of downtown.
That sounds very picturesque.
Yeah, it's pretty nice. Got mountains and can put a kayak in the river in the middle of downtown, and it's nice.
There's kind of a tech scene down there, is there not?
Yeah, it's definitely growing. There wasn't too much of one when we moved here about, I guess, almost 7 years ago now. But it's definitely been growing, and we have the... they call it the gig. We have a gigabit internet that you can get to your house for like $70 a month, which is pretty awesome.
What?
It's crazy. And that's gig up and down, which is just nuts. But yeah, it's crazy.
Well, I prefer to be honest and have a slow internet connection like the public.
Same here. Actually, I pay for the lower one. So, you know, I'll take the 100 megs up and down. That's fine for me.
That's way more than I got. So I'm still... and it's like $3,000 a month in my studio.
Oh, geez.
For 10 up and 10 down. Because I'm in a wonderful historic building in New York.
Indeed.
And the one thing I didn't ask the broker when we, this is not where I live, this is where a space apart my studio is. The one thing I didn't ask is, how's the internet? I was like, oh, it's the original lobby. Oh, what marvelous architects they were in 1905. You know, I was like really excited. I was really excited about that. I didn't realize that nobody from even the 20th century serviced the building. So you have to.
They bring the internet in on horse and buggy, basically.
No dumb trucks for you. They run a cable for us from like the internet itself.
Nice.
And charge a penny per mile. And so I guess we're 300,000 miles from the internet is how that works out. You have a lot going on. You run a magazine called Web Standard Sherpa, and you have a conference as well, right? A virtual conference?
No, actually. So we have Web Standard Sherpa, and actually as of April 2nd, we'll be closing that down.
And why are you closing it?
Sure. So Web Standard Sherpa was a project we started at the Web Standards Project when I was a manager there. And the idea was to create a best practices resource for web designers and developers to basically be able to submit their sites that they had worked on and actually get valuable critique, like constructive criticism from experts in the field. So, you know, Jared Spool, Dan Rubin, Aaron Cassane, Derek Featherstone, Ben Callahan. We've had a lot of really awesome people over the years who've been working on this project with us, which has been great.
And this was provided free to the public?
Yes. Yeah. We didn't do advertising or anything like that. It was all sponsored. It was largely sponsored by Microsoft for, I think, the first 2 or 3 years. They helped us get the site off the ground. We had contributions from Mozilla. We had donations from Ellis Lab, the folks behind Expression Engine. Media Temple donated the hosting, all of that sort of stuff. So we had lots of people who were kind of rallying behind it. But we've been kind of struggling internally. We lost our first editor, Steph Troth, who was amazing. And it took us a while to find somebody to replace her. We eventually got Emily Lewis, who is also amazing.
And a good author as well.
Oh, yeah. She's an excellent author.
Good developer as well.
Yep. Super organized. We've worked with her on a couple of projects now as well. We were running into some problems editorially.
I never knew it was connected with the Web Standards Project.
Yeah. So it was originally an outgrowth of that. And we tried to run it through there. That, you know, Web Standards Project, as you know, from when you were running it, didn't exist legally as an organization. So it had no, no ability to get bank accounts and stuff like that. So we ended up running kind of the fiscal part of it through Easy Designs, my consultancy, which, you know, had some tax implications for us, but,
very familiar to me. This is a very familiar story.
So, cool. we did that for a while.
That was good of you.
You know, we tried to give it a good run. Thanks. Yeah, Dan Cederholm did an amazing job on the design for it. It was a lot of fun to work on. We redid it, not like redid the entire site, but we made it responsive, because when the site came out in 2010, 2011, somewhere in there, I guess March of 2011, we had done... I think the whole thing was done desktop first originally. We had some media queries in there, but it was not all that great. So we redid that as mobile first responsive, I guess, about a year and a half ago. And things were going okay, but we were struggling to find more sponsorship dollars and really not wanting to go the advertising route. Not that we had anything specifically against it, but I don't know. It felt odd to us to do that. And
because you're more of a nonprofit.
Yeah, exactly. And
once
we
you
contemplated
start
kickstarting and stuff like that, but yeah,
that's cool. That would have worked.
It could have, but then we weren't really sure if it was worth kind of continuing on. So right now,
wait a minute. Who designed Shirley the Goat? It says
that
Feed
was
Shirley.
That was Dan.
I had no idea he could illustrate like that.
Oh yeah, yeah. He did the entire site, did all the illustrations in it, and everything like that. And
I've worked with him, but I never knew he could do that too.
Yeah, he's multi-talented. I know.
Yeah, the Dan Cederholm, founder of Dribbble. He was on the show a few weeks ago. Brilliant guy. Wonderful to work with too.
Like super down to earth. Very good. Super on time.
Like most people that I've met in web design, no matter what, how brilliant they are, they just seem like totally normal, humble, down to earth. I still can't get over it because I worked in other fields before that, and humility is not the norm.
Especially in the advertising world.
Indeed.
On the 2nd of April will be kind of the last official day of Sherpa. And if I could do a brief plug, we're actually doing an online virtual conference for Sherpa.
Okay.
To help to raise some funds to permanently ensconce the site, basically to pay for the domain, pay for hosting for the foreseeable future, to get it archived, all of that sort of stuff, and make sure that it can stay online as a resource. So it's a pretty inexpensive conference that the Environments for Humans people are running for us. So we're pretty excited about that. And that'll be on the 2nd.
That'll be on April 2nd. You've got Laura Kalbag, Derek Featherstone,
Dan Mall,
Nicole Slaw. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Nicole Fenton.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so it should be good. And then we're also doing like a live Q&A with the speakers and a couple more of the Sherpas. So people that have like pressing questions and such can kind of call in, ask their questions, and we'll answer them and tackle them in real time, kind of like the Q&A stuff that we had started, where people would basically ask us, what's the best way to deal with, HTML5 audio in a cross-browser way and that sort of stuff. So we're kind of taking that portion of the site live as well as part of that. I guess you could call it a wake for Web Standard Sherpa.
Is there any way to find... I mean, you have recently taken a position at Microsoft after freelancing and running your own studio for like 10, 15 years. Mm-hmm. You recently took a position at Microsoft. Is there any way to get to work with them to keep this? This seems like a really valuable service.
I mean, it definitely is. I don't know. I would feel weird now that I'm their employee about like, hey, here's this project that I was running and, give us more money, because I mean, they've honestly given us a lot of money over the years. It's something that I could explore, but we had a conversation as a staff and kind of decided that we felt like it was a good time to actually wind things up. So we're sad about it, but it's kind of a bittersweet thing. We're all interested in moving on and doing some other stuff. But we want to make sure that the information that's there, because it is super valuable and it is really helpful and still relevant stuff. We want to make sure that's around in perpetuity. So that's our plan. And, I don't know, maybe one day the Sherpas will rise again, and surely the goat will come back, but we'll see.
And stop calling me Shirley.
Exactly. But yeah, the other thing that I've been doing kind of in the side time, which I'm not sure if this is the conference you're thinking about, but we run a tech talk series here in Chattanooga called Coding Creativity, and we run that every other month. And it's kind of an interesting model. We do a one local speaker that's kind of an opening act, so to speak, and then a headliner that's somebody we bring in from outside. And we've had some amazing speakers over the years. We've had Steve Fisher, Jen Lucas, Steph Troth, Kate Kiefer Lee, Nicholas Akis. I mean, we've had a lot of really awesome people come in and give talks. This last month, end of February, we had Lisa Welshman, whose book Managing Chaos just came out from Rosenfeld Media. And she did this amazing talk that was about how the code that we write affects the culture of our organizations and how we organize ourselves
affects.
So as we work more agilely, you know, does that necessitate us creating more agile teams where essentially you've got a pool of resources and you kind of do super friends assemble, you know, to do a particular project or aspect of a project and then disperse again and kind of into the cloud, the way that we do the same thing with objects within a database or within, you know, various interfaces. We kind of assemble interfaces on the fly from a collection of a bunch of different data objects and stuff like that. And she was connecting all of those sorts of pieces, which was phenomenally interesting. And Jessica Ivins, who used to work for Happy Cog up in Philly, she actually lives in Chattanooga now. She's working at Center. And she was our opener, and she did a fantastic talk on designing for gendered audiences, which was all about how to deal with, you know, things like fluid gender and stuff like that, and how to take that stuff into account and be a little bit more empathetic towards our users.
That sounds really cool. And I see you got Josh Brewer and Madeline Daugherty coming up.
Madeline Daugherty. Yep.
This is at codeandcreativity.com, not codingcreativity.com. It's completely different. Codeandcreativity.com. It's pretty site. Now, who designed that?
I did that one.
I thought so. It's very googie.
It's very Aaron. It's very 50s kind
totally.
Of style. You know me in that mid-century modern stuff.
Absolutely. Well, that's our childhood.
Yeah. Well, not so much
mine. My childhood.
I was born in the 70s.
Okay.
My childhood was not nearly as fun. Yeah. Okay. I have a real affection for that era.
Wait, so you were a kid during the sexual revolution, and by the time you were an adult, it was AIDS and herpes
Well, I was born in 77, so I grew up in the AIDS generation and the being terrified of sex and all that fun stuff. So,
are people still scared?
I have no idea. I've been married for 13 years. Yeah. I have no idea. I haven't been in the dating pool forever. I grew up when it was morning in America, as it were. So it was kind of a bizarre time. It's interesting to look back at all that stuff.
The Gipper was your president.
He was. I liked him because he had the same first name as Ronald McDonald.
Wow. Okay. Now you seem very young when you say that. I was a punk when Reagan was in office. I was an angry punk. It was a great thing to rebel against.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And I became a punk shortly thereafter.
It's hard to be a punk when Clinton was president, though.
Well, but by the time George W. got in there, you know.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah.
And I had an affectation.
Not to be political just.
No.
I mean, the affect of the different guys. Like Clinton's so genial, right? Well, actually, the Gipper was genial, too.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Do you remember that Saturday Night Live routine with... where he's,
Clinton playing sax on Saturday Night Live, but that's about the extent of it.
This was Ronald Reagan actually a really tough guy, like with making plans to invade Nicaragua with the Secret Service. And then a little Girl Scout comes to the door and he says, and he acts all senile and grandfatherly and, well, I hope the Democrats will be as sweet as these cookies are or something like that. And the girl goes away and he's like, where were we?
Nice.
What's his name? That wonderful actor whose wife shot him from Saturday Night Live.
Oh gosh, I don't even remember that.
He was in the first few years of The Simpsons. You may remember me from such short films as
I remember The Simpsons
Driving.
Back when it was
Highway
on
to Death.
You know, I remember back when it was on Tracy Ullman, The Simpsons.
Wow. Okay, you go back.
So I go back. My favorite Ronald Reagan bit though has still got to be. Do you remember Spitting Image back in the '80s? That was the puppet show that was super political and kind of crazy. And I think they actually did all the puppeteering behind the Land of Confusion video for Genesis. Which that was the one that had Ronald Reagan riding the like triceratops and pushing the button for the bomb when he was trying to call his nurse or something like that.
You just said a whole bunch of words that didn't make sense. Like Land of Confusion video by Genesis. I'm just like looking at those words. I didn't know Genesis made videos. I thought they were before that.
I think it was Genesis. Maybe it was just Phil Collins solo, but I could have sworn it was Genesis. But anyway, you should definitely check out the Land of Confusion video because it's all puppeteering and it kind of reminds me of, Spitting Image was the show that was on and it was a British puppet show. And they all looked like they were made of like styrofoam or like a really like soft foam, almost like the foam that they use for baffling microphones and stuff like that. And making rooms unlike mine sound dampened. That was a really awesome and heavily political comedy show. And then they did the video for Land of Confusion. But yeah, there's nothing quite like Ronald Reagan riding a triceratops.
I don't remember that, but I do remember Sledgehammer by Peter Gabriel.
Oh yeah, nice one.
And of course at the beginning of the '80s it was Once in a Lifetime by Talking Heads. Mm-hmm. It was the first video that just where I said, oh, this isn't. There was the first time the video actually seemed like art instead of someone gave the band $100 and pointed a camera at them.
Exactly. Yeah, it was interesting to see kind of the evolution of MTV growing up because I was maybe 8 or no, younger than that, maybe 7 when MTV came on, somewhere around there. Cool. And I remember seeing it when it literally first came on and seeing Video Killed the Radio Star as the first video and stuff like that.
That was quite prophetic. Oh, it was a different star. And Madonna was a completely different kind of star.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of the rock bands, I mean, I think Bowie was fine, but a lot of the mm-hmm. bands would never have made it.
Yeah. You know?
I mean, music was changing anyway. That's always happening and that's always exciting. But
and it's always cyclical.
When I think of the 80s, I think of Laurie Anderson and Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Yes, which there's a new Pee-wee movie coming out, I heard.
That might be very depressing.
It could either be really good or really depressing, yeah. Who knows?
Are all the original cast going to be there? Is Miss Yvonne going to be there?
I don't know the details yet. I just heard about it the other day, but I was pretty excited, but nervously excited.
Yeah. Is Tim Burton going to direct?
That I do not know. There were this massive body of knowledge that we could check and verify some of these details.
If only there was something, I would contribute to it myself. If there was some body of interconnected
information,
stories and information narratives,
I'd even be helpful.
But I wonder what it would look like.
Yeah, I don't know.
Would it look like a book?
Yeah, I don't know.
What's your take on the way websites look nowadays?
Let's see. I don't know. I feel like there's still, as there always has been. I mean, honestly, if we kind of go back, there's still a lot of style over substance, or all sizzle, no steak kind of stuff. Like the Flipboard thing really depressed me. The moving to having the whole site rendered in Canvas as opposed to actually having a DOM, having the document object model there to underpin it, to provide accessibility, to know, give some sort of stability. I'm just kind of, I scratch my head over this fascination with 60 frames per second. I don't get it. And maybe that's why
it's... Back up and explain what you're talking about.
So yeah, a couple weeks ago, I guess, Flipboard released their web version, instead of their app version that was right. native. And when they did so, they basically they're using, I believe, React, which is a product from Facebook.
React.js.
Yes. And they are generating the entire site into Canvas. So the Canvas element. And so there is no markup apart from that. And so that's kind of caused a big stir, as anything on the internet does.
But so basically, if you don't have the right desktop browser, or maybe some smartphone browser, you can't see anything.
Correct.
What happens on your smartphone?
If there's any error in JavaScript,
right.
I don't know. I could pull out. Yeah. I mean, if there's no JavaScript, there's no Canvas. So if anything causes JavaScript to stop executing, whether that's just waiting for the page to load, whether that's, you know, an error in the JavaScript, I was able to break it pretty quickly by logging into my account. And then I scrolled down through the kind of page, I guess, the Canvas, and clicked a YouTube video. And as soon as the YouTube video finished, it basically broke the entire site. So that's pretty awful. So all of this, the reason that they went this route was apparently because they wanted the site to run at 60 frames a second, which is I don't know, I've heard people refer to it as buttery smooth, which is, you know, that seems to be the frame rate that
for web TV. What were they thinking of?
I don't know.
I've heard Jake Archibald talk about this, right? Mm-hmm. Talk about frame rates and why there's, you know, why an HD movie that you're watching in HD on a website still flickers, or why it flickers on a DVD, or why it flickers even on Blu-ray, because the frame rate in Blu-ray doesn't match the frame rate at which it was shot. And so when you're panning across the desert in Lawrence of Arabia, it's going to jitter. Basically, yeah. No matter how much quality went into every phase of production, it's still going to jitter. And if you get a Criterion disc, right, there's like,
yep.
You know, of one of the best pinnacle. Films ever made, yeah. You know, and all that stuff. And it's like, you know, a high quality transfer, it's still going to jitter. So is the 60 frames per second for that reason? And are they saying, I don't understand, are they saying that, well, this is mostly static content. What's the 60 frames per second? I mean,
they were complaining that it wasn't scrolling smoothly enough.
That's what it's about.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's at least as I understand it. I could be wrong. I didn't dive too deep into the whole conversation because honestly, I was just kind of turned off by the whole idea of rendering an entire page in Canvas.
Of course, you wrote the book on progressive enhancement, right? Your
right.
book, Adaptive Web Design, is all about the 10 million reasons why a site should always render no matter what, and that we enhance right. upward. Instead mm-hmm. of making something that works for some people some of the time.
Yeah. Well, and there was a huge pushback from folks who were like, I think Farouk Atesh was one of the people who kind of came out and said, you know, hey, this is not accessible at all. Like the content is not available. You've effectively recreated Flash from like the very early days of Flash.
Right.
And, you know, none of this content is available to anyone who uses assistive technology. None of this is available to screen readers. None of this is available to search engine indexers.
But how could they not know that before they did the work? And it's beautiful work. Let's not take that away from
no.
anyone.
No, but
how could they not know?
I'm sure that they did. I mean, they're very smart people that work at Flipboard. I imagine that they weighed the pros and cons. And I mean, I've been in meetings where people have made decisions to go with a particular technology or to do one thing or another that, you know, seems in my mind to completely go against all reason, but they do it because, you know, they want some, you know, sexy view or animation or whatever it is. They've got it in their mind that they absolutely need to have this one thing. Like, we absolutely need to have 60 frames a second for smooth scrolling, in order to give it a native app like feel.
And honestly, why is the type? I just clicked through to the Facebook section, which for some reason contains no data, even though I'm a very
awesome
active Facebook user.
And the on Facebook? What?
And the type looks very strange. It looks like someone took Verdana and then, I don't know, like rendered it in Windows and then mapped the kerning from Windows.
And then photocopied it and put it back on the...
Yeah, it looks like it was part of an experiment. It's weird. It's so not smooth on my very smooth screen. So I'm not sure what's going on there. But I don't want to... I hate to bust on anyone's work. And we are... What you are faulting, and I agree with you, is not the quality of the work, but just the decision obviously made by someone in charge.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it was a designer who said, like, I want it to be smooth? This goes on forever. I don't like the scroll bars. Remember that? I have to use Flash because the scroll bars in the browser are ugly. I want pretty scroll bars. I mean, what we give up for silly things like that. Well, I guess it's always, this was the Web Standards Project struggle, right? And I guess it's still going on. There's this tension between experimenting and omitting people consciously.
Yeah.
And experimenting while trying to find a way to include everyone. Maybe they won't have the same experience, but that's okay.
Right. And that's kind of where I end up falling. I mean, I don't even want to hazard a guess as to who made the particular decision at Flipboard. It's, you know, to me, that's, you know, somewhat irrelevant. They put out a product and it looks really nice, but I'm concerned about its longevity. I'm concerned about its accessibility. I'm concerned about it from a business perspective for them, because to me, it's, you know, the things that we build, the more opportunities we create for them to go beyond the devices and the platforms that we're aware of, the more opportunities we create to do better business, basically. So, and there's, you know, just a ton of people in the world who are yet to come online and will likely be coming online on mobile devices that are far from what you and I are used to. You know, they're not the flagship phones that most of us in our industry have. They're more like the Firefox OS phones that you can buy for $35 in India. You know, they're the UbiSlate tablets that, you know, runs the latest version of Android, but is doing so on like a 480 by, you know, 600 screen or something like that. That's really low resolution, but that has a long lasting battery and that, you know, works over 3G. You know, it's not, you're not working over a fast LTE connection or something like that. And I think the more we kind design for something that can go anywhere, the more opportunities we create for our businesses to succeed.
I agree, but I sometimes wonder, with all the complexity, if the web standards dream is dead. You know, design once, publish everywhere, right? Create once, publish everywhere. Is that dead?
Well, I guess the question is, like, what is the complexity? Is the complexity the technology, or is the complexity stuff that we're doing to make our lives more complex? I mean, one of the things that I've kind of been struggling with over the last, I don't know, probably year and a half, is I feel like we've been spending a lot of time as a web design development community creating tools to, you know, ostensibly make our lives easier, make production easier, make things faster, what have you. And we seem to be spending less time focusing on solving user problems. It's like we're spending all this time building stuff for ourselves or building things to try and become the next rock star developer that everybody wants to know or what have you. And we're not thinking as much about the people who actually have to use the stuff. So, you know, we take shortcuts that make life easier for us to develop, but actually make things more difficult for the people who are trying to use our sites.
The canonical example would be, I want to make something quickly. So I use a framework and I don't optimize it. I just use the framework as is. And then I'm forcing a user on a feature phone to download a bunch of code, or I'm forcing a user that they can't use, or I'm forcing a user on a feature phone or on a slow connection to download a bunch of kilobytes of stuff that they can't use instead of coding from scratch. Just as a simple example.
Or just, you know, spending the time, as you said, like taking out the stuff you're not using. I mean, the number of sites that are out there that have more than one JavaScript framework pulled into them is pretty amazing. I remember a story from a colleague who he was brought in to consult on performance optimization for a fairly major retailer. And he found that they had jQuery, Prototype, Scriptaculous, I think MooTools, MochiKit, like all of these were all in the site. And they were each being used for individual little things. And so one of the first things he did was go in there and clean out all of that stuff and focus on it just being, you know, using one JavaScript library like jQuery or what have you. And they were like, wow, this is so much faster. And, you know, we no longer have 2 megs of JavaScript that we're trying to download. But I mean, there's, you know, a lot of times we get so caught up in just trying to make things work, we don't think about how to kind of optimize things for our users and make them work well for everyone. It's all about just kind of clocking in, getting the job done, and clocking out. I mean, it's, you know, there are so many people who kind of live and die by what's on Stack Overflow and just copy and paste from there without really thinking about it. I mean, it's kind of what's gotten us into the mess with other browsers having to implement WebKit prefixed CSS because nobody bothered to do the non-vendor prefixed version because, you know, WebKit border radius worked and they just moved on.
I think it was Matt Marquis who's always talking about we're getting better and better at designing sites that solve our problems. And every time we solve our problem at the expense of a user, we're basically committing a crime against design and against user experience. That what we should be doing is doing the extra work on our end, not making the user do extra work, whether that work consists of waiting for something to load or discovering that they can't access the content because they're using the wrong tool or, you know, the wrong device and they have to come back, whatever it is. Anytime we offload a problem to the user, it's very much against what design should do. And it's also therefore very much against the notion of what web standards is about, which is content for all.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's a big tension in our community between the idea of design and the idea of art as well.
What do you mean?
Art to me is very much self-expression, and it's something that I don't mean this in a bad way, but it's very ego-driven. It's about us, and it's about what we're trying to get across, what we're trying to convey, what emotions we want people to feel when they see the stuff that we create. And design, you know, uses a lot of the same tools of aesthetics and such, but design, if you go back into the etymology of the word, was originally to mark out, to indicate. It was about solving problems. And Jeff Veen often talks about this as well. Is design is problem solving. And so if you're out there making something because you're doing it to show off and show what a badass designer or developer you are, you're not actually designing. All you're doing is you're making art on the web. And there's certainly
Mike Montero says a designer without a client is an artist.
Right. Right. Exactly. But I think there are a lot of, you know, quote unquote designers who convince their clients, whether they're internal or external, that, you know, a particular concept that they've come up with is, you know, a good idea. And it's more about, you know, creating a showcase piece for their portfolio than it is about actually solving the needs of the users of that particular
company. It's actually true of some of our most famous graphic designers as well. They're style masters who kind of make one thing after another that looks the same, regardless of whether it's for a podiatrist or, I don't know, I couldn't really go anywhere after podiatrist. I have to take a short, like 30-second break to thank our sponsor today.
Sure.
And there's someone you know, Aaron. It's today's Big Web Show is sponsored by An Event Apart.
Oh, I have heard of this conference.
The design conference for people who make websites. You've spoken at this conference once when you weren't wearing pants.
Yes, I was in a kilt when I presented in 2009.
I was going to leave it to the listener's imagination. How you spoke without wearing pants. But yes, you were in a kilt. Quite correct. Coming May 11th through the 13th in Avetta Park, Boston, is an intensely educational learning session for passionate practitioners of standards-based web design. If you care about code as well as content, usability as well as design, and Avetta Park is the conference you've been waiting for. See John Hicks, author of the Icon Handbook and designer of such earth-shaking icons as the Firefox logo, explain the icon design process. Design for Social Behavior with Sarah Parmenter. Develop smaller, faster websites with Matt Marquis. Learn CSS grid layout with Rachel Andrew. Atomic Design with Brad Frost. SVG Techniques for You and Me with Chris Coyer. And Responsive Design from its inventor, Ethan Marcotte, plus many more. I'll be there myself, talking. Learn more and check the complete schedule for An Event Apart Boston at aneventapart.com. That's aneventapart.com. And hey, Big Web Show fans, save $100 on An Event Apart Boston in May or on any 2 or 3 day An Event Apart event this year with discount code AEABWS for Big Web Show. That's AEABWS for $100 off at Event Apart Boston or any AEA 2 or 3 day show in 2015. You're going to be speaking at Event Apart yourself, are you not?
I will. I'll be in DC in August.
That will be DC in August. It's better than it sounds, right? When you hear DC in August, if you've ever lived in DC or just been in DC in August, it's not.
It sounds sweltering. But it won't be.
Maybe, but it will. Well, because we're going to be wearing spacesuits, air-conditioned spacesuits.
Well, and there will be a good breeze while I'm on the podium, too. So
you're doing it again. You're doing the kilts again?
No. I wasn't going to do the kilt again. I'll probably rock a bow tie for you.
That's for DC. That would be perfect.
We'll see. I'll pick out a good one.
Are you watching House of Cards?
I am.
Don't tell me how it's... Season 3 ends.
I haven't finished the season yet.
It's very grim. Yeah.
It's always grim. I mean, the whole show started out pretty grim. I mean, when he walked up and just broke the dog's neck in that first, like first 5 minutes, you're like, oh.
Yeah. Well, it's Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, there's a villain. We don't know why he's a villain. He proves that he's a villain as soon as he walks on the stage. And then we root for him while waiting for everything to unravel.
Yeah. Have you watched the British series?
No, it's in my queue. I have not. But you know the difference between the British and the American series besides Kevin Spacey.
No, what is the difference?
So I was just talking about this with Jen Simmons. Netflix, you designed the series with data. They looked at their own data. So they bought an existing series, an existing British series. And they said, okay, this is great. Well, this seems like a good Kevin Spacey vehicle. And Spacey got on board. And then they said, all right, what do we know about how people watch Kevin Spacey movies on Netflix? How far in do they get before they pause? What scenes do they interact with the most? What seems to be the most popular? What are the things in Kevin Spacey vehicles that seem most exciting to our viewers? Let's make sure we have plenty of that stuff. And how do people feel about sex and violence? What combination? How much sex? How much violence do they like? Do they want explicit sex? They probably couldn't do that. But they just mine the data like Amazon would mine data, like you or I would look at Google Analytics to see if our site's converting, right?
Right.
They did what any site owner would do, but not with a website, but with art, right?
That's fascinating.
Right? So this is art that's designed like a product because Netflix, you know, they're very serious about becoming a content provider, not just a content distributor. and they wanted to have a massive success. And it makes you wonder, will Scorsese start doing this next? You know what I mean? I mean, a lot of the people on HBO who used to make independent films, but who now direct television, because television seems to be where that kind of talent can get rewarded. They can look at, you know, I know for all we know, they were deciding how long before they had to kill Steve Buscemi in a series, right? Yeah. If they weren't doing it, they will be. That's what's going to be happening. And which gets us into privacy and expectations and whether things are really improving or not.
Yeah. I don't know. Netflix is making a killing, that's for sure.
Well, how much time do you actually have to watch television?
I don't know. It varies. I mean, when I'm traveling, especially when I'm traveling alone, I take a little bit more time probably to watch stuff to unwind at the end of the night. But I don't know. At home, we probably watch a couple shows a week. It all depends what we're in the mood for. We're big Walking Dead fans, so usually our Sunday nights involves Walking Dead, and sometimes Girls. We'll see. All depends what's going on.
I have become a TV junkie, and I wasn't for like decades. Right, so hipsters who don't watch TV don't annoy me because I get that. But you know, I'm a dad, so I'm home a lot, and actually, that's not even the reason. Because when I travel, I love that. I love that. Like after the stress of travel, to just like go, I'm going to catch up with it. That's how I saw The Wire. I didn't see it at the time. I caught up with The Wire, you know, afterwards. It's weird, but in some strange way, the work that we do ushered in even this change, right? Ushered in this new way of absorbing television, this new way of absorbing media. Yeah. Now, if someone says they watch Kroll Show, does that mean they have a cable and a subscription to Comedy Central? Or does it mean they're watching old episodes for free on Netflix? Or does it mean they're paying for them on Amazon? Or does it mean something else?
Yeah.
It's about the content. It's not about the distribution. It is to the distributor, but not to the consumer anymore.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see how successful HBO Now is going to be now that they're kind of breaking with the idea of being tied to a cable subscription. So,
boy, everybody's excited about that. The thing that I hate about most of those things right now is up until this point, you had to sign in with a cable account.
Right.
So if you wanted to watch Showtime, and if your cable company is, for whatever reason, not cooperating with Showtime or whoever, or they're being locked out by a competitor, let's say Comcast is keeping Time Warner Cable out to make Time Warner Cable more eager to merge with them. So they cut a deal with Showtime, and then you're a Time Warner Cable subscriber, and you can't watch this program that you actually subscribe to, but you can't watch it on your laptop. You can't watch it on your lap device because of corporate wrangling.
Yeah. Politics, basically.
Which gets me back into how much I love the web, which is so unlike any of that, right? Because we share everything. When you were talking about web standard Sherpa, right, people would come and you would gather experts to give them feedback on their websites. Can you imagine any other business where people would do that for free, where top-rated experts would just give advice for free? I can't.
No. I mean, even just comparing our industry to the kind of IT world overall, it's just a very different beast. I don't find it nearly as kind of cutthroat. You know, I've seen in the IT world a lot, you know, people who've been at a company for a long time are very nervous when new hires come in, nervous that, you know, that person will know a lot more and they'll take their job and that sort of thing. Whereas, I don't know, we don't seem to have, at least I won't say that doesn't exist on the web, but it exists a lot less on the web. I think we tend to be much more sharing focused. And I think a lot of that comes from the roots of how most of us learned the web. I mean, we learned it by viewing source of other people's websites, and then we're like, oh, that's how they did that. And, I'm interested to see if that starts to change over time as you know, as the industry has grown, certainly the culture of our industry has kind of changed. I mean, just looking at South by Southwest as kind of a barometer of what's been going on kind of in the web world. You know, I remember back when it was, you know, four rooms in the corner of the convention center, and that's, you know, where we all would meet up and just kind of sit on the floor in between sessions and stuff like that. And
have you been having this painful nostalgia I have this week?
Yeah, a bit, but at the same time had absolutely no interest in going to Austin as much as I love the city. I didn't feel like dealing with kind of the number of marketers and quote unquote social media experts and app developers and stuff like that. I don't know. I feel like South by Southwest isn't for me anymore.
It isn't for us. It's not for do-gooder nerds. As I read in an article on Medium or somewhere. I mean, that's who the early years of South by Southwest Interactive were for. Like mm-hmm. the web standards project and Twitter when it was three people with an idea and,
yep.
you know, when, well, really way before Twitter, Blogger.
Yeah. Right?
All that stuff and movable type evangelists for blogging, evangelists for development.
Yeah, the first year I went to Interactive was 2000, and the trade show, if you could even call it that, was like a corner of the trade show floor, and there was a guy selling a content management system based on FileMaker. And that was like the most exciting thing that was going on at
That's
the time
so
at the
sweet.
Trade show. Yeah, I know. It's so it's kind of nice to look back at that and be like, wow, that was an innocent time.
That was it. Yeah. It's like looking at, I've said this before, but it's like I'm watching Buffy the Vampire Slayer now. And when you look at 90s graphics, you realize how far we've come.
Oh, yes.
Just look at like the intro to that show and, you know, which was, I guess, it was campy and everything at the time, but it was also, mm-hmm. you know, considered good graphic design. And
yeah.
I can't imagine how it was considered. I love the show, but I can't imagine how that was good graphic design. Just like, mm-hmm. really? Really?
Yeah.
There must have been dissenters back then, but now it looks appalling. All that stuff. You were talking about IT. One of the, and I don't want to jump on an industry, but one of the most discouraging things I've found as a designer working for clients is that there can be a lot of resistance in IT and a lot of power concentrated there. For example, we once presented to a major museum, and one of the things we wanted to do was get them off their $1 million, $1,000 license per user, creaky, anti-standards compliant content management system and get them onto something basically like Expression Engine or Drupal, something mm-hmm. Incredibly inexpensive and, you know, very customizable, giving them the actual, basically a content management system designed for the design of the site instead of, and for designed for what they wanted to achieve now and a year from now, instead of designed around a bunch of spaghetti code that already existed. And we were shot down by the IT guy who called me over and put his hand on me. And it was very mafia-like to me. He put his hand on my shoulder and said, "You're telling me to get rid of my employees who are experts in, I won't name the system, it doesn't matter. And, you know, we've got, like he said, I've got like 3 years till I retire. And these people have families." And it was that. It was like, I'm not going to replace a bunch of people who are qualified to use this system that has no future. I'm not going to replace them with something that the content people can use themselves.
Yeah.
That was demoralizing to me.
Yeah.
I got it. I understand wanting to protect your employees. I totally got that. But it just seemed like, so you're going to spend $1 million of this organization's money every year, not even counting staff, just on this technology that has no future.
Yep.
On this technology that has no future. It's sort of like defending tobacco production or something. It's like, yeah, no, I get it. If we all stop smoking, people will lose their jobs. That really sucks. But on the other hand, lung cancer, that sucks. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, so it felt kind of like that.
Yeah, it's one of those tough arguments to have for sure.
You used to make custom content management systems. I've worked with you on those in the past.
Yeah, we built a couple over the years. A lot of stuff in PHP, a couple things in Ruby, and I think when we started working together, or rather when we wrapped up working together, we had moved over to almost being entirely an expression engine shop. Mm-hmm. We still did a few customized content management systems, but yeah, I mean, to your point, it was all about figuring out what it is that you're trying to do, and then trying to match the content management system to those needs, as opposed to trying to, you know, essentially buying into a content management system and then trying to get your design and your needs for the site to fit into, you know, how that specific thing works.
Now, what's the difference between picking something like Expression Engine, picking a content management system that works and that has a big community of support, and adapting it for your clients? What's the difference between that, which we like, and picking frameworks to build stuff? Couldn't you argue it's the exact same thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's all about the tools that you're using to create, you know, the experience that you're trying to design, right? So, I mean, whether that is a back end system or a front end system, it's the same sort of thing. And I mean, I think the same rules apply. You need to look at what the pros and cons are and actually look at them in a realistic way and recognize, you know, what are the trade-offs for choosing to go with system X over system Y. Some of those trade-offs may be on the back end in terms of, additional requirements on the developers for how they're building things and how the system is organized. Some of that may be additional requirements, you know, especially in the terms of a front-end framework, additional requirements on the client side that, you know, nobody who's running a slower processor is going to be able to use this site, or it's going to be, you know, really mind-numbingly painful for them to do so, or it just won't load on an old BlackBerry because there's not enough RAM. So yeah, I think there's a lot of the same trade-offs, and I think there should be the same amount of due diligence in making those decisions. I mean, even when you're deciding on, you know, something as simple as like whether to use a CSS framework or not, or whether to include Modernizer or not, or whether to use jQuery. I mean, for most things these days, if you're targeting mostly newer browsers, you probably don't really need jQuery anymore because of, you know, CSS transitions and because of all of the adjustments that have happened in JavaScript in terms of being able to, you know, find an element in the DOM via a CSS selector. And I mean, that was most of the reason that jQuery became so popular early on, is because it made it really easy for designers to write JavaScript. But right. A lot of that stuff is native in the browser now, and you don't even need to load a 30K library to be able to do that.
Right. You can just say, you could just use HTML5. You don't need to load JavaScript to make a form know that you're typing in a phone number. You just use the correct, yeah.
Which is awesome. I mean, the more declarative awesome. Our markup can be, and the less JavaScript we have to use, the better off everybody is.
Do you worry that to some extent HTML5 blends behavior a little bit into markup?
Yeah. I mean, as far as like HTML5, the spec goes, to right, me, it feels like it's a lot of mixed content, basically. Like there's the API end of things. There's the actual markup end of things. And to me, I would have much preferred, even if they still wanted to have it all under the kind of HTML umbrella, I think I would have preferred a modularization of all of that stuff along lines of what they've been doing with CSS, so that everything can kind of run its own course. Because, you know, XML HTTP request, XHR, you know, that's, I believe, part of the HTML5 spec, but really it has zero to do with markup. So, you know, does it really need to be tied to, you know, HTML5 as kind of a monolithic spec? I don't think so. I think it would be good to break that stuff out like we did with CSS.
Why do you think they did it the way they did it?
I have no idea. it would all be speculation. I have no idea why.
It would be, but they're browser makers. So maybe to a browser maker, right? Maybe the purity of separation of markup from behavior and appearance doesn't mean that much. They have to render everything, or maybe, maybe they wanted to, you know, maybe they thought it would be simpler, right, for people to learn.
It could be, but I mean, if you read through the spec is not very, it's not necessarily written for us as web page authors.
No, definitely not.
And honestly, like there is some necessary mixing, and this is, if I had to hazard a guess, the reason would probably be something along the lines of, well, you know, when you're creating new elements like the video element or the audio element or what have you, these new controls have an API based interface that is needed on top of that. And it doesn't make sense to define that outside of the HTML spec. And that kind of opens the floodgates to, well, if we're putting, you know, the APIs for dynamic manipulation of video and audio into the HTML spec, why not put XHR in there too? Or why not put, you know, X, Y, or Z other,
why not put responsive images in there? I mean, which is what we're doing.
Yep.
And if responsive images work, you know, if in the future image and picture, in the very near future, if they don't require a JavaScript polyfill, that might be nice, right? Mm-hmm. If you can do everything, it's just another of those trade-offs, right?
Yes.
Purity versus utility, I suppose.
Indeed. I mean, I think the one thing that's nice about the modularization that happened with CSS, and I was very skeptical about that when they initially proposed it.
Sure.
But I think the idea of separating it out and thereby allowing the different modules to run at their own speed is, you know, it helps us to avoid, you know, the 10 years of stagnation that we saw at the W3C when there was no, you know, nobody was really looking at updating HTML. Nobody was really looking at, you know, actually implementing CSS 2.1. I mean, that spec was, you know, a candidate recommendation forever and finally became an actual spec, but it took a long time to get there, just because, you know, people weren't implementing it because it was such a monolithic thing. So I think they learned from that and then pushed forward with the modularization stuff, which, you know, there seems to be constant movement, which is a good thing to see from the W3C.
Yes, I agree. I think the slowness of the W3C had something to do with the slowness of IE to change.
It's possible.
And it had something to do with the web catching up with the stuff the W3C had been working on. And it probably also had something to do with the web kind of rejecting where XML, where XHTML was going.
Oh, yeah. XHTML2 was that was a cluster.
Yeah, well, that was purity. That was purity. We did this wrong. Let's stop supporting image. There should never have been an image element. Let's stop supporting it.
Yeah, there's an authoring mistake.
There's an authoring mistake let's make sure that the browser quits working altogether.
Yep. Let's turn XHTML into JavaScript.
I was so panicky. I remember being so panicky about XHTML2 and speaking to its chief author and just saying, you know, because I was out there going, XHTML is the way. It's awesome. Look, you're going to do really well-formed markup if you do this. And it's like, where this is going basically seems anti-developer and anti-user because stuff won't work. So, yeah. But that's why scientists are scientists. You know, they didn't call them standards. They called them recommendations. We called them standards.
Yep.
Now everybody calls them standards. But if we hadn't done that, they'd still be recommendations and we'd still be using Flash.
And the blink tag and marquee.
Right on. Listen, we have to wrap up. It's been wonderful. You've got a new version of your book coming out soon. When should we expect that?
I'm hoping to have it written and ready to be published by the end of the year. So it'll be out in time for the holidays. So that's wonderful. The plan.
And who are you publishing that with, a publisher this time or doing it yourself again?
So I'm actually going to be publishing it with New Writers. They came to me and they were very, very excited about the opportunity to take it from being a self-published book to being a publisher-published book. And so, yeah, New Writers will be putting it out.
I love them. They're great. And they took chances on me when nobody else would. and always feel, always love them. Well, thank you. We wish you good luck with that.
Thank you.
And good luck at Microsoft, and we'll see you at Innovate Apart.
Absolutely.
And folks, have a great day. Bye-bye.